Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The White House says it deeply regrets today's decision by a Scottish government minister to release the Libyan man convicted of the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland in 1988. The bombing killed 270 people. Most were Americans. Abdel Basset Al-Megrahi has only served 8 years of a life sentence for the bombing, but he's dying of prostate cancer. And on grounds of compassion, the Scottish minister freed him today. While the Libyan government has accepted responsibility for the bombing, many in Britain believe that Al-Megrahi was not guilty. The BBC's Peter Hunt joins us from Glasgow. And Peter, what did the government minister say about his decision to release Al-Megrahi?
Well, it was a very lengthy explanation, indeed a justification of this decision. I think he appreciated that the eyes of the world, particularly the eyes of America, were on him, and he acknowledged that there were deeply held feelings about the case. He acknowledged that many would disagree with his ruling, and he talked explicitly and in detail about how the American administration had made its views clear to him, and some of the relatives in America during a video conference call had made their views clear to him. And he said that the fact that Mr. Megrahi didn't show any compassion to his victims wasn't a reason for us to deny compassion to him and his family in his final days. And in an almost biblical part of his very lengthy address to the media, he talked about how Mr. Megrahi now faces a sentence imposed by a higher power. The government minister went on, "It is one that no court in any jurisdiction, in any land, could revoke or overrule. It is terminal, final, and irrevocable. He is going to die."
Remind us exactly of who he is and his connection to Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi.
Well, he's said to be a distant relative of Gaddafi. Gaddafi is said to have taken a keen personal interest in this case. Indeed, Gaddafi is said to have be sending his own personal plane to bring this man back to Tripoli. In terms of his connection with the case, it's been long gone over ever since he was indicted by the American and the British authorities many years ago, and he is linked to the case, they say, and the evidence was put before court and the judges ruled on it, convicting him of his guilt, that there was a material clothing in a suitcase containing the bomb. The clothing was bought in Malta, and the owner of the shop positively identified Megrahi as the purchaser of that clothing. And his job when he was in Malta, he was working for one of the Libyan airlines, but the belief of the FBI is that he was a Libyan intelligence officer.
Despite the evidence that you mentioned, the clothing and whatnot, has there been a lot of debate about his exact role, what it may have been in the Lockerbie bombing?
There's been a lot of debate here in Britain, and by and large, the relatives in Britain, some of them believe that Megrahi is a victim of a miscarriage of justice. Others feel that there has been a lost opportunity. When Megrahi only days ago abandoned his second appeal, they were pinning a lot of hopes on that judicial hearing as a means of, for them, they hoped, of finally getting some answers, that even if Megrahi was guilty, who else was involved? Were there others involved? There's talk of secret documents that were coming up before this appeal, which the British, the UK government, had insisted they didn't want published because it would threaten British national security. So they feel there are questions to be answered, questions which they say have existed since this flight exploded over the skies of Scotland 21 years ago, and their fear now is that with Megrahi returning home to die, they'll never get those answers.
The folks who say that he did not do it and he's innocent, if it wasn't him, who do they think it was?
Well, he, right back in 2001, talked of Palestinian extremists, and he put the finger of blame on Iran and said it was a revenge from Iran for the accidental shooting down by an American warship of an Iranian plane 5 months before the Lockerbie bombing.
How are people reacting to this? Are there folks outside the government minister's office protesting, or what about the families of some of the victims?
I think with the passage of time, it inevitably means that the emotions aren't as raw, so there won't be the protests that you're suggesting outside government ministers. I think we know what the reactions will be, because people have been reacting ever since it was first leaked more than a week ago that this was likely to be his decision. Libya is no longer a pariah state. Britain in particular is very keen. Various British companies are involved in oil exploration in Libya, so the world has moved on, and I think the relatives feel that they have been left behind, particularly with their quest for the total truth, the complete truth about this, which was the largest and worst terrorist atrocity on UK soil.
The BBC's Peter Hunt joining us from Glasgow, Scotland. Peter, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
The wrangling over health care reform continues in Washington, with the Wall Street Journal reporting that the White House and congressional Democrats may split a reform bill into two parts in an effort to get some things passed this year. This follows weeks of angry town hall meetings and polls showing dwindling public support for many congressional reform efforts. Among those rallying the opposition is Amy Menefee with the group Patients First. The group is on a nationwide bus tour. Its logo is Hands Off My Healthcare. And Amy, we're reaching you right now on tour in Indiana. You don't want the government involved in healthcare, you say, but Medicare, Medicaid, and Veterans Health are government-run programs. What is it about those programs that make you opposed, especially to a public option for healthcare for everyone?
The issue with putting everyone onto a government program is that with programs like Medicare and Medicaid, you know, they're losing a lot of money to fraud every year. We're not doing a good job of policing that. The programs are also unsustainable the way that they're set up, because right now Medicare is about $37 trillion in debt, and, you know, the Congress hasn't figured out a way to keep that going, even for the people that it's already promised to.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, if you could reform the system, what would you do then?
Well, I think I would do several things. I mean, some of the ideas that we support, they're all things that would give patients, people as patients and as consumers of health insurance, more options, including giving people a tax credit to help them buy health insurance and give them the same benefit that people get that get it through their employer, and then to give them the opportunity to shop across state lines for health insurance, give them more marketplaces where they can shop and compare prices and benefits.
So basically a sort of free market approach to reforming health care, which you agree needs to be reformed.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But haven't we learned lessons, though, from the free market approach and what it's done certainly to the housing market and what's happened on Wall Street? And can we take any lessons from that and apply it here?
Well, I would actually say the markets that we've seen that have had problems, it was because they were not free enough. And so it's not that the market actually failed. It's that we actually need people to have more accountability and more competition.
Does that mean that we shouldn't even have Medicare, really?
No, I'm not advocating getting rid of the assistance that we have for people. I don't think we need to try to control costs by dictating what type of care people get. That's exactly what they do in the United Kingdom, where they actually do a cost-benefit analysis on people in order to, you know, quote-unquote, control costs by controlling the type of care that people are able to receive.
Well, I think that this particular proposal doesn't necessarily say that anyone would be denied or that it would be a system like Britain's where there would be a price tag on something, but there would be a discussion with folks about the intensive procedures that are often done at the end of people's lives. And so folks can weigh whether it's not just financially worth it, but whether it's worth it to put the patient through something like that.
Well, I think those are discussions that people should have with their families and with their doctor, and people are concerned about having this in legislation because they don't feel that anyone from the government should be telling them what to do about making those types of decisions.
Some folks said, you know, in Great Britain, we may not have the record that the United States has in terms of dealing with some catastrophic illnesses, but overall, folks in Great Britain live longer than the average American.
Well, I'm glad for them because they also have to wait longer for their treatment in many cases. that's one of the things that happens. Of course, they have a lot fewer people there. They have a smaller country as well.
All right. Amy Menefee is policy advisor with the group Patients First, which has been on nationwide bus tours. Its logo is Hands Off My Healthcare. Amy, thanks for being with us.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
Well, when it comes to health insurance plans, federal employees have a pretty good deal. The Federal Employee Health Benefits Program is open to full-time permanent federal workers, and it offers a wide choice of insurance plans. Workers pay about a quarter of the premium's cost. The federal government or taxpayers pay the rest. Insurers want in because it reaches a good demographic, the more than 8 million people who work for Uncle Sam. And costs can be kept down because there's so many people buying in. Stephen Kagan is a Democratic congressman from Wisconsin. He's also a doctor, and he's opted not to be in this program. In fact, he's uninsured. And Representative Kagan, why don't you get insurance through the program?
Well, when I was elected to represent the people of Northeast Wisconsin, I didn't go to Washington for health care benefits. I was elected to bring about the changes we need, like guaranteeing access to affordable care for everyone, not just members of Congress or other federal employees. But in your introduction, you highlighted exactly what we need in the country. we need to have a large purchasing pool to leverage down prices for everyone. And the way you do that is put 8 million federal workers together, or here in the state of Wisconsin and across state lines. Let's leverage the purchasing power by putting the largest risk pools possible together. We can do this.
Let's talk a little bit about the program itself. How does it work? I understand there's, first of all, there's a lot of choice. And basically, a federal worker can almost customize coverage that works for the worker and the worker's family. Is that right?
Well, not having studied all the programs, I can tell you what was offered to me. When I went down to the basement of the Cannon office building after my orientation in December of 2006, I was offered a cafeteria of plans. And I asked the woman who offered the plans to me, I said, well, look, I've got to catch a plane. What did you take? She said, well, I took the cafeteria plan that's the best for me. It's the Cadillac plan, $250 deductible, and they have to take you. They can't cherry pick against you. They can't discriminate because, well, we're federal employees. So you're going to take that one, Dr. Kagan? I said, no, I respectfully decline until you can make that same offer to everyone that I have the honor of representing. What we need are choices. What we need is coverage for the things that matter most, and that's our health care. And that's exactly what I believe President Obama is trying to do, as is the House and the Senate. We're going to come to some agreements. There'll be some things we disagree on. But in the end, we'll be guaranteeing access to affordable care for everyone, just as we've done for all of the federal employees.
I understand that for federal employees, for lawmakers in particular, they're allowed special treatment at Washington's federal medical facilities, and they can also have an option that if they pay a little bit extra, they would have their own pharmacy and doctors in an office right between the House and Senate chambers. Is that right?
Well, it's a tremendous access to medical care. When I had knee surgery in January and needed a doctor immediately, they were right downstairs from the House chamber, and that's one of the benefits of being in Congress. There are some other benefits like traveling and making certain that we're always available to listen to people, but you do want your representatives to be healthy. You want the doctors to be present as close as possible. But why shouldn't everybody have that opportunity?
When you had your knee surgery in January then, did you use these doctors?
No, I did not. I sought my own doctor. It was a medical student that I had trained when I was teaching in medical school. And my doctor ordered an MRI. And wouldn't you know it, his large medical clinic had an MRI machine. And I said, well, Mark, I bet you got an MRI machine, but I have no insurance, so what does it cost? He said, well, it's about $1,400. I said, well, you run such a good operation here. You're very efficient, low overhead. I'll bet you make money at the Medicare rate. He said, well, we do okay. I said, what do you take as full payment from Medicare? $413.
Wow.
How about I write you a check for $413? So you see, the real price for health care, whether it's an MRI or a surgical procedure or a doctor visit or a hospital care, is whatever they can get. There are many, many different charges for the same service.
We're speaking with Wisconsin Congressman Steve Kagan, who is uninsured. We'll have more with him after a break. It's Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Congressman Steve Kagan, a Democrat from Wisconsin who's also a doctor and the only member of Congress who does not have health insurance. Kagan has refused his federal health insurance until his uninsured constituents are offered the same. And Congressman, before the break, you described how you negotiated the price of an MRI that you needed before your knee surgery. How did you handle the knee surgery?
Well, I went to a surgeon in Washington, D.C., because I wouldn't be able to fly for 6 weeks after my knee surgery, and I found what I believed to be the most skilled and experienced knee surgeon, and I presented my digital records, my MRI scan. He looked at it and said, well, you need surgery. I said, fine, what's it going to cost? Because I have no insurance. And my doctor said, well, does that mean I'm doing this for nothing? I said, no, I just want you to charge me the same amount you're going to charge everybody else in the Washington, D.C. area, because I want you to openly disclose your price and charge everyone the same for the same service. And he said it may take some time to figure out what the price is going to be.
He didn't know the price.
He didn't know the price because the price is dependent upon the insurance and a whole constellation of other things. Like, for example, when he went into my knee, he didn't know what he was going to find exactly, so he couldn't tell me exactly what he'd be doing. So given that situation, I suggested that the degree of pain I was in wouldn't warrant waiting for him to finish determining what the price should be, and I'd like to try it before I buy it. Do the surgery, fix me up, and then we can decide about the price later. And several months later, we arrived at a price that was a 50% discount off of the $8,400 that otherwise would have been charged by his computer.
Do you think that most people would be able to do something like that?
I think that people need to ask questions and find out what the real price is. The real fundamental reason I ran for Congress was my patients were having difficulty. They couldn't afford their insurance coverage. They were losing their coverage at work. And when I'd write a prescription and a mother would take the prescription to the counter of the pharmacy, she could see the medicine, but she couldn't afford to buy it and put it in the mouth of her kids. So where I come from as a doctor, I want to guarantee that we have equal treatment at the pharmacy counter, which is very simple. I want a menu. You know, one of my sons works at a restaurant, and if you go into that pizzeria and order a sausage 12-inch pizza, it's $12.50 for you and $12.50 for me, and they don't discriminate. They'll treat everyone to a great pizza, and they'll openly disclose the price and charge everyone the same. That's where we need to be at the pharmacy, at the hospital, and at every doctor's office. Mm. It's just immoral. It's just un-American to have a situation where you don't know the price of a pill before you swallow it.
You know, there are some folks who might be listening and might think, you can possibly afford almost, quote-unquote, to be uninsured. You're a doctor, you're a member of Congress, you've got resources. A lot of people aren't in that position.
Well, I'd like every member of Congress to be in my position, put their head on their pillow every night, as I do, wondering if this is the night I'm going to lose my home, this is the day I'm going to be really sick, and need a fantastic amount of care that's available but maybe unaffordable. I think if every member of Congress were to go naked, so to speak, without insurance, we'd solve this problem within a week. Why don't we have a transparent medical marketplace where insurance companies can sell a standard policy that guarantees that if you're sick, you'll be in your house, not the poor house? And when every insurance company is selling the same basic standard plan, they can't say no to any citizen or legal resident. In an open and transparent marketplace, will leverage down the price significantly. Some experts say anywhere between 18% to 22%.
What about these town hall meetings? What are you hearing from your constituents? It's my understanding that there are folks who say, you know what, we do not want government in our health care.
Well, the government is involved in your health care now, whether it's Medicare, Medicaid, all veterans who get veterans benefits. That's government-sponsored and government-assisted health care. And you want good government involved in your health. After all, the only reason you don't see polio in your neighborhood or smallpox in our children is because of effective, good government. So we need our government to be actively involved. What I think people are really saying at the town halls that I've been to, a couple of things. First of all, they're very visceral. They're very emotional when they say, I don't want government in my health care. And to me as a doctor, I don't want the government in the examination getting between me and my patients. I don't want the corporate insurance company in the room as they are now. So people here in Northeast Wisconsin have said this single message over and over. Kagan, fix what's broken and improve on the rest. Guarantee we have coverage at a price we can afford to pay. That's my goal. And I think that's what Congress has in mind.
I think that there are some folks who also are saying they're very concerned about the bureaucracy of government.
Absolutely, as am I. When I first came to Congress, and I believe it was January, February 2007, in my office, I had a meeting with, I believe, the assistant director of CMS. Now, they're in charge of authorizing waivers for prescription drug programs like Wisconsin's Senior Care. Wisconsin put together a purchasing pool of senior citizens in low-income situations as a buying pool. And today there are about a little over 90,000 senior citizens who take advantage of this buying pool to leverage down prices in prescription drugs. And I'll use my mother as an example. She's in assisted living, and I take care of her. She's my dependent. Her prescription drugs cost $113 a month. Well, January of 2008, I was kind of busy in Congress. I forgot to write the $30 entrance to the buying pool, which is the fee to get into senior care. And there's no donut hole in senior care. She had the prices go from $113 to over $300. It was the same prescription, same medication, same producer of the medication, same pharmacy. The only difference was she wasn't in a buying pool. So what we need to do is apply that concept of lower drug prices for prescription drugs for everybody. If I go into the pharmacy to get my mother's medication and I'm on the same medicine, is there any reason why I can't get that same discount? If the drug company is making money at $113, they're making a lot more money at over $300. So I think what we have to do in healthcare across the country is to establish for the first time a true medical marketplace. And we can do that by first enacting no discrimination against any citizen due to any pre-existing condition. We secured a generation ago equality at the lunch counter. Now we need equality with regard to our insurance companies.
Wisconsin Congressman Steve Kagan, he's refusing federal health care benefits. Congressman, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we speak with a Republican member of Congress who's also a doctor and get his take on health care reform. That's tomorrow, back after the news, Here and Now. New regulations on credit cards take effect today. They essentially put limits on what card issuers can charge consumers. The rules are part of the Credit Card Reform Act, which was signed into law in May. And here to tell us about some of the changes is Terry Savage. She's a nationally syndicated Chicago Sun-Times financial columnist. She's also author of the forthcoming book, The Savage Number: How Much Money Do You Really Need to Retire? Welcome, Terry.
Good to be with you.
Can you explain some of the changes that are taking effect today?
Well, two changes are taking effect. First of all, card issuers, they have to mail out your credit card statement now 21 days in advance instead of 14. That'll solve the problem consumers have of either being away and not getting the bill, or the post office messes up and you wind up paying a day or two late and get a late fee. The second provision requires card issuers to give you 45 days notice when they plan to raise your rate instead of what had been 15 days notice. So that's really behind the rash of rate increases you've seen over the last 6 weeks. The card companies were aware this was coming, and they decided to get in ahead of everybody else and raise the rates even on good customers.
We'll talk about that in just a second, but first let's talk about, this is really only the first step of the Credit Card Reform Act, because more regulations will go into effect next year.
That's right. The big regulations that go into effect next year mean that they won't be able to raise the rate on your existing balance, only new balances, and that when you pay a bill, the payment will go toward the balance with the highest rate. And there'll be some other things, too. You know, now you get an over-limit fee frequently if you aren't keeping track of how much you've charged. They'll give you a chance to opt out of that system and say, look, if I'm going to be over the limit, just decline my credit card at the point of purchase so you won't be subject to fees.
Also, the credit card companies will not be allowed to market credit cards to people under 21.
Yes, that's going to be a big thing. Today, our kids go off to college, and right next to the bookstore is a table with a free sweatshirt for signing up for some bank's Visa or MasterCard. Starting next year, a parent or guardian will have to co-sign for anyone under 21, unless the student can prove he or she is financially responsible, has an income, and could pay back the debt.
Now, you mentioned that already credit card companies have started increasing their rates to prepare for some of these changes. What else are they doing in response?
Well, credit card companies are not just responding to this new law. They're responding to the fact that they have increasing charge-offs, write-offs, as people go bankrupt and just default on debt. So the average charge-off rate used to be maybe 3% on a portfolio of credit cards. Today, it is up over 10%. Bank of America, one of the largest issuers, has over 13% write-offs, just people who aren't paying their bills. So they are trying to do everything they can to earn more money. They are cutting back the limits for many people. They are raising the rates even on their best customers, the ones that pay regularly and pay even more than the minimums.
And they're also, I read, charging annual fees, charging more to transfer your balances or for foreign transactions.
Yes. Now only about 20% of cards have an annual fee, but because they've been restricted now on raising rates without much notice, they're going to start charging fees. You're going to find out that your card will now come with an annual fee, or they're going to be making a variable rate card so they don't have to notify you. You'll sign up for a new card, and your interest rate will vary.
So what should consumers do here to make sure that rates won't go up unexpectedly?
There is one and only one great deal from a credit card company. That's to get a no annual fee credit card and pay it off in full every month. If you're going to carry a balance, you are subject to the whims of the card issuer. So you could go to bankrate.com, for example, and find low rate cards. But there's no guarantee those rates won't be going up in the future, even with advance notice. Your real way out is to pay down that debt. And the simple way, if you can do this, is to take a look at your bill today, double the current monthly minimum payment. Keep paying that same amount, and your credit card balance will be paid off in a little over 2 years. Then you don't have to worry about the deals. It'll be a convenience. Charge a plane ticket, rent a car. You need a credit card, but you need to use it wisely.
Terry Savage is a nationally syndicated Chicago Sun-Times financial columnist. Terry, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And we'll link you to more information about the credit card regulations at our website, hereandnow.org. We'll be back in 30 seconds with a lesson in cloud seeding, the science of making it rain. It's Here and Now. Welcome back. The most arid state in the nation is about to become drier. Nevada gets only 9.5 inches of precipitation a year. That's the lowest rate in the U.S. And now, state budget cuts have forced the closing of a cloud seeding program that helped provide water to about 130,000 homes and helped keep grasslands wet and nourished for cattle and wildlife. The closing of the program at the Reno-based Desert Research Institute comes at a time when Nevada is already in a drought and when other western states are either expanding or starting cloud seeding programs. The DRI program was seen as a pioneer in the research and development of rainmaking techniques, including manipulating clouds from the ground. Before the program shut down, Philip Ross, senior editor at IEEE Spectrum magazine, traveled to Nevada to find out how scientists can make the sky cry.
Cloud seeding is partly a science, partly a black art. You have to work through a lot of statistics just to see if anything's happening. Under ideal conditions, seeding may increase precipitation by up to 10%, but to get that payoff, seeders must choose their clouds wisely. Arlen Huggins, a scientist at the Desert Research Institute, explains.
The ideal cloud are actually relatively shallow. We're looking for clouds that aren't particularly efficient at producing precipitation. Usually the very, very deep clouds are also very, very cold and produce a lot of ice and snow on their own. And as the cloud tops lower, there's a lot less natural ice in them.
Rainmaking, or rather snowmaking, has been going on in the Sierras for 50 years. I asked Huggins what he does with all the snow.
I do absolutely nothing with it. Nature just takes over, and as the spring, as it gradually warms up, the snow starts to melt, runs into the streams, and that becomes Nevada's water supply pretty much. We rely almost entirely on snow melt for city water, municipal water, agricultural water.
We climb into a truck and drive past the flat desert plain to the pine-clad hills half an hour west of Reno, to Troy. Arriving at a road underpass at the foot of a hill, we park and follow Tom Swafford, a field technician, past the puddles at the bottom and up a steep hill knee-deep in snow. I'm standing beside a sheet metal box about the size of an office cubicle. On it, there's a 10-foot tower topped by what looks like an oil drum. A tank in the box pipes fuel to the drum. The fuel consists of acetone, in which a tiny bit of silver iodide has been dissolved. When you burn the acetone, the silver iodide wafts away as microscopic crystals, each one a potential seed for a snowflake.
A typical episode is roughly 8 hours or 9 hours, make it even, so 3 gallons.
And in those 3 gallons, you'll get a certain amount of powder. If I were to hold all that powder in my hand, it would be just a few handfuls?
Yeah, it wouldn't even be that much.
The raw material in that handful costs about $70. I ask Arlen how much snow it could produce.
You can increase the precipitation rate by about a half to 1 millimeter an hour. So say you were able to create a half an inch of snow. So a half an inch of snow times 35 square miles, and that you'd have the volume.
Let the record show that it comes to 41 million cubic feet of snow, which melts out to 30 million gallons of water, enough to supply Reno's homes for one day. All from a smidgen of seed solution piped up from a metal cabinet to a burner.
You'll hear a loud click. That'll be the valve opening to allow propane. You'll hear the whoosh of the propane and the flame will light. Once the solution flow starts to go, you'll actually be able to see the flame through the bottom of the drum here. It'll be a large orange flame comes out. The solution will start to flow. There it comes right now. Now we're in normal operation. We're seeding clouds.
Reno needs all the rain and snow it can get. But there are places in the world where people mainly want the rain to just go away. I ask Arlen Huggins whether anyone has ever tried to use cloud seeding to wring water out of a storm before it hits.
No technology I've known will change the water budget to that scale where you completely rain out a cloud. That's what the Chinese were trying to do before the Summer Olympics. They were trying to seed clouds upwind of Beijing. Parts of the Olympics I saw, it was raining almost every day.
With the machine pumping powder into the air, we head back to Reno to see how scientists measure the effects of seeding. Tom leads the way, stamping holes through the snowbanks, and we all follow in his footsteps.
A description of this type of walking is post-holing.
I'm in a garage almost as big as a hangar, peering at a glass box the size of a refrigerator. It's a cloud chamber, and the scientists are using it to measure some of the effects of their cloud seeding work.
What you're hearing is a compressor from the refrigeration unit that cools down the cloud chamber. Take the flashlight and shine it in there. You can see the cloud that's being created. So it's just like a fog.
Well, the fact that I can see the trail of the light, well, the light shows it as a fog.
Right. And inside of that is cooled down to about minus 20 centigrade. But as you can see, the water drops are still water drops. They're not ice crystals.
The cloud chamber detects the presence of seeding material. It contains a cloud of water vapor that's kept way below the freezing point. Yet that water can't freeze because there are no seeds on which ice can form. But when a mote of silver iodide drifts into the chamber, kapow, you get a tiny crystal of ice. And you can see it sparkle if you shine a light on it. To see how well the chamber does its job, we stand 30 feet away and burn a match that's been dipped in silver iodide solution. Then we wait.
One. That was the first one.
Two. See them? You just see a little glints of light?
Yes. It'll take the better part of the day to air out the garage enough to stop the cloud chamber from beeping. Each beep is an ice crystal. Each crystal, a potential flake of snow, the source of more than 90% of the water drunk in Reno. It all starts with a few handfuls of powder. Mighty storms from tiny seeds do grow.
That's Philip Ross, senior editor at IEEE Spectrum, the magazine for technology insiders. For more on their series, The Global Water Challenge, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Just a reminder, you can listen to today's show stream live on our website, hereandnow.org. For past programs, click on the archives. And you can download a podcast and take us with you wherever you go. That's hereandnow.org. And before we go today, believe it or not, despite the recession, Ripley's is expanding its houses of oddities. You're listening to Here and Now. It was one of the scarier moments of this baseball season when the New York Mets' David Wright was hit in the head by a 94-mile-an-hour pitch from Matt Cain of the San Francisco Giants. Wright was wearing a helmet, as required by Major League Baseball, but he suffered a concussion, and his status for the rest of the season isn't clear. Now, there's no indication that Cain hit Wright on purpose, but there's no denying that pitchers sometimes do deliberately throw at batters. And Harvard Law Professor Alan Dershowitz says it's time to ban beanballs, those pitches that are deliberately thrown at batters' heads. He says the pitchers and the managers responsible should be severely punished, possibly even face criminal charges. Dershowitz's op-ed about this appeared in the Boston Globe this week, and he joins us to talk about it. Professor, why are you making this case right now?
It's getting worse, I think. It's getting worse. Pitchers are being told by their managers to headhunt. It's only a matter of time before a batter is hit below the helmet or on the forehead and killed. It happened almost 90 years ago. It happened when I was a young lawyer in Boston to Tony Conigliaro, who died as the result of being hit on the head, though he died several years later. There's no question that his death as a young man was attributable to being hit on the head. And it's enough that the risk players have to take in accidentally being beaten the way Wright was. But Euclid,
Kevin Euclid of the Boston Red Sox.
They threw at him deliberately. I'm confident, although I have no evidence of it, that it didn't happen simply because the pitcher decided to do it. But in general, in these cases, the manager instructs the pitcher to throw at the batter because he's crowding the plate or because he is a dangerous hitter and you want to scare him a little bit. And that's just unacceptable.
Now, we should say that the Red Sox, Kevin Euclid, was suspended for 5 games because he charged the mound, and a whole bench-clearing brawl came up after that. And what's wrong with the suspension?
There's nothing wrong with that suspension. What's wrong with the pitcher was being suspended for only 5 games as well, which really has no impact on a pitcher who pitches every 5 days, whereas Euclid missed 25 at-bats and 5 full games. The Sox lost 4 of those and only won 1. Whereas the pitcher who deliberately threw at him hardly was suspended at all. So the message that's sent to managers and pitchers is that it pays to go after a star batter because the pitcher is not going to suffer anything comparable to what the batter is going to suffer if he's provoked into charging the mound. It's not a suspendable offense to accidentally hit a batter. Now, it's going to be difficult, as I say in my article, to make the case often, but when it's clear, the consequences have to be draconian. That is, if a manager is found to have instructed a pitcher to throw dangerously at a batter, that manager's career should be over. Look, this is much more serious than steroids, and I think at the very least, if you throw at a batter's head, he shouldn't get 1 base, he should get 4 bases. It should really have a consequence in the game itself. But today, it has almost no consequence for the pitcher or the pitcher's team.
So is that part of what you call a zero-tolerance policy? That's what you're advocating for?
I'm advocating a zero-tolerance policy, and that policy just doesn't exist today in baseball. In fact, if you ask old-timers, they'll say, you know, brushing back a batter, making sure he pays a price for crowding the plate, it's part of the game. No, it's not part of the game that I love. It's not part of the game that I've been watching for 60 years. It's not part of the game that I went to Ebbets Field to cheer Jackie Robinson for. You know, Babe Ruth, in his autobiography, commends one of the great pitchers, Walter Johnson, because he never threw at a batter. He said, that guy was not only a great pitcher, he was a gentleman. That's the way the game should be played. And it's cheating to do it any other way.
Harvard Law Professor Alan Dershowitz, his most recent book is The Case for Moral Clarity. Professor Dershowitz, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
For more than a century, Ripley's Believe It or Not has entertained people with what are described as oddities, weird art, or unusual memorabilia. For example, a portrait of President Obama made of gumballs, or a six-legged calf, or a mysterious shrunken human head made by a tribe in Ecuador. And despite the recession, Ripley's is expanding and is expected to have 8 new museums within the next few years. The problem for Ripley's is that with more museums to fill, they're having trouble finding enough weird stuff. Edward Meyer is Vice President of Exhibits and Archives at Ripley Entertainment Incorporated, and he joins us from his office in Orlando, Florida. And Mr. Meyer, how do you find some of the oddities to put in a Ripley's museum?
We have a team of researchers that are always looking for things on the internet, on television shows, in magazines. We find, believe it or not, everywhere. The majority, however, find us. You know, our company has been in business for 90 plus years now, that if you've got something odd, unusual, unique, typically we're one of the first people somebody will phone. Hey, Mr. Ripley, you know, a six-legged cow was born on my farm. You know, we are pretty high on their phone list.
Do you have one of your favorite stories about an object that Ripley's was either negotiating for or ended up acquiring or maybe never acquired?
My personal favorite, there are maybe as many as 7. I personally have seen 4 at this point in my life. Regular hat pin with the Lord's Prayer engraved on the end of it. Micro miniature. You cannot see it with the naked eye. And it was done by a gentleman in prison for forgery. He was a jeweler by trade and sort of saw God when he was in prison and decided to mend his ways. The one we own was originally displayed at the World's Fair in Chicago in 1893, and it was pretty well documented through the 20s, and it disappeared. This thing was lost for roughly 55 years, and a gentleman in Seattle, Washington, famous collector and creator of miniatures, Orville Elton was his name. He had over 30,000 miniatures. Orville had never inventoried his collection, and he offered me a little bit of money and a whole lot of barter on the side if I'd help him inventory some of his collection. And while doing so, I found this pin amongst some other very neat things, but he didn't even know he had it. He doesn't know where it came from, how long he'd had it. So I had been chasing it at that point for more than 10 years. So I was pretty excited, and I'd still say out of the over 20,000 items I've purchased in my career, it would be either number one or number two. And, you know, the chase is a big part of it, the thrill of the hunt.
Is there an object right now that is new that you hunted for that, you know, is going to be coming out in the very near future at one of your newer museums?
The latest thing I've acquired, and this is just a wonderful, wonderful artwork, created from cassette audio tapes. A young lady in Atlanta has somehow managed to discover that you can make people's portraits out of those cassette tapes. And she has done a wonderful series of personalities, celebrities, rock musicians, etc., from broken up cassette tapes. The Jimi Hendrix is one of the most incredible pieces I've seen in months. Got a fabulous Amy Winehouse, got an excellent Bob Dylan, and there's no paint, there's nothing else but the little tape that came out of that cassette.
Edward Meyer is Vice President of Exhibits and Archives at Ripley Entertainment Incorporated. He's been speaking with us about the oddities that he's seen. Best of luck to you, Mr. Meyer.
Well, thank you very much.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.